This is an examination of the hidden human condition.
This is the Hidden Killers Podcast
with Tony Bruschi.
Yeah, it is. And Kaylee Turin is with us. She's a defense attorney out of Nashville. And Kaylee, let's play a little round of defend this. I'm going to throw some things at you that look pretty damning, but I'm curious to get, you know, it's kind of on the spot thoughts on how you could defend against something like that. Let's talk about the cell phone data for a little bit. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's a lot of that shows him going to and from that area. The triangulation is pretty concrete on where that is all taking place. And then the fact that the cell phone turns off precisely during the times of the murders and then turns back on in a relatively realistic timetable for when he'd be getting back in his vehicle. And it shows him leaving that area in the middle of the night.
Right.
This is obviously something that is going to be admissible. It will end up being in court. How does one defend against a piece like that?
Well, I will say it is not for certain it's admissible yet, because okay, we don't know if the search warrant followed the letter of the law. I've had a couple of cases where it's like glaring, like you did not follow proper procedure on that. So that's where I would first look at is the search warrant, the affidavits, and make sure they are perfectly conforming to that letter of the law. Because if they're not, that is a quick motion to suppress to try and get that data out. But also looking at a map of Moscow, Idaho, and where the house was, it looks like they are pretty much not a remote area. They're near a university and things like that. And all they would need to prove is, yeah, I mean, he was a student too. He could have had friends around that area. Yeah, it's a little weird, but it's also the middle of the night. People turn off their phones in the middle of the night sometimes. It's rare they do that, but they do. So that's where I would first look in and be like, hey, do you have any friends in the area? That kind of thing. What were you doing? And I would look at it that way and try and show like, hey, this is just a mistake. It's a coincidence. You know, he's unlucky.
Mm-hmm. What about when we talk about the knife sheath and the DNA that was found there? And then, of course, genealogically traced back to the parents and so forth.
Right. That's a tough one.
Yeah.
I mean, and it looks like they've said that it's conclusive that it is his DNA. There's not, you know, 75% chance it is most likely him. I would then look at, so we have TBI agents here that do the lab tests and everything. Mm-hmm. I would first look to see if the lab analysts, if there's been any case law against them that, you know, those cases have been overturned because of procedure. It's very unlikely, but most likely you're going to have to concoct some story, because that's going to be really hard to get out and to get out of the minds of the potential jurors if it does go to a jury trial.
How does that work logistically when you're working with a client and you have things like that to concoct a story? I mean, you can't correct me if I'm wrong, but you can't just like make something up, correct? You have to have some sort of basis for it. Does that basis have to come from the client themselves? Or is it something that you can kind of help? Well, were you here? Were you there? And then they can just agree, and then you can go in that direction. Logistically, in the background, how does that sort of process take place?
So every attorney is different. You know, I treat jurors as not stupid. They can see through these crazy made-up stories and everything like that. But you have to also think with your conversations with your client, if you know they are lying and they go up on the stand and lie, we have to, in Tennessee, immediately withdraw off of the case. Mm-hmm. So we get put into a kind of like need to know kind of thing. Like, all right, I'm going to ask you these questions and everything. And obviously, whatever they tell us doesn't leave us, but it gives us a pause to, do we want you on the stand? Because, you know, if you're going to say something different, I can't be your lawyer, that sort of thing. So it's not really making up a story, more of creating doubt. Like, this is, you know, a thriving college campus. Look, there were multiple parties going on. You know, two out of the four were at a Sigma Chi party. The other two were at a different bar. You know, there's multiple, you know, social scenes. Just because he doesn't go to the university doesn't mean he was out, not able to go to those parties, that kind of thing. So it's more of creating doubt.
And obviously, we don't need to show motive in a case like this, but there does seem to be a lot of interesting evidence. A jury's going to want some sort of motive. There's clearly been a pattern of behavior with Brian Koberger, innocent or not, that shows issues with women or difficulty relating to women, putting it lightly. That seems to be an ongoing theme throughout his life. I'm sure they'll probably have many people probably testifying to that as well, along with the evidence that's been seen online and of his the way he got fired from the university. Are those things, let me ask you, number one, do you think that things like that will end up being admissible in court as they are in somewhat, you know, not quite solid, not necessarily even related to the case? Unless we're going down that road of being part of the motive.
Right. So I think it's going to be a little bit hard to prove that it's not prejudicial and overly prejudicial to the defendant. Because, I mean, that isn't really related to motive. It's more personality. So if he, for example, got up on the stand and was like, I'm a ladies' man. I know how to relate to them and everything else like that. The state can then give rebuttal proof, which we saw in the Murdaugh case, where they had rebuttal witnesses and to kind of disprove that. But to just do it on the case in chief, I think it will be very hard for them to do that.
What, in your opinion, is going to be the biggest hurdle for the defense of Koberger in this case? Maybe it's something I already brought up, but I don't know.
Yeah, the DNA on the knife sheath. Yeah. I think that's going to be the hardest thing. You know, cell phone data, you can say, you know, cell phones are unreliable. I worked a case where the judge on the record said, hey, I had a, you know, stolen cell phone pinged to my house for some reason. It was actually 3 miles away. There are problems with it. It's rare, but DNA really does not lie, especially when it's at that high of a proof. I think it was 99.9998% that it was accurate. You really can't fight that too much. And a jury's going to look at it and be like, well, your DNA was there. What's the reason you were there? Give us a different reason. If they don't have that, it's going to be very hard to go over that hurdle in this case.
And we still don't know what the conclusions were, what the findings were on the pieces that were taken out of his home. Some of them sounding rather questionable. Blood-like stains, red stains, brown stains, as they described them. Possibly some furs, fibers, things of that nature, maybe from the crime scene, maybe from that home. We don't know what the results of that would be as of this moment. Will all of those sort of pieces of evidence be presented on June 26th or in that time window before an actual trial takes place? So everyone knows what's on the table. Everyone knows what can be presented. And then Koberger can make an educated decision of, I want to continue to plead not guilty, or say, you know, what's the point here? You got me.
Right. And so I think that's a big conversation with the defense attorney and the prosecutor, and just be like, all right, you know, what are you wanting to do? I mean, he's looking at four victims here. So probably consecutive life sentences on each of them. So if they can work it where, hey, you know, let's get through probable cause. We'll show you, you know, bare minimum like that. Maybe we can work out a deal. Or here, you know, we can waive preliminary hearings and in return get a bond reduction. Here, that's not going to happen.
Sure.
But it's more of, you know, is he even looking to plead guilty? That kind of thing. And the defense attorney can be like, all right, let's have a full-fledged prelim. I'll put on my proof that I've had so far. You put on yours. And then we make a decision on a type of offer. But in Tennessee, we have victims' rights laws where they have to be consulted. So I think the prosecutor on any deal that's given will have to consult with these four families and make sure everybody's on board with that. So that's going to also play into the prosecution side on that as well.
How much opinion is it up to the families, or is it they're just able to express their opinion and ultimately the court makes the decision?
They can ultimately express their opinions, but their opinions do have some weight. Now, we've had families, you know, on theft cases. I want them to do the maximum amount of time. It's not realistic. With somebody with no criminal history, it's a minimal theft charge, that kind of thing. Prosecutors most likely going to be like, no. But this is a big murder case, big national case as well. So they have to take that into consideration, because you don't want the families voicing all over the news how upset they are with you as the prosecutor. Because I'm not sure if the prosecutor in that area is elected or not. And, you know, everything goes back to political. So that might have something to do with it as well.
Sure. And as everything always does.
Mm-hmm. This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi.
Kaylee Turin, thank you so much for coming on and giving us your insight into this case and playing that round of a game that I just came up with. Defend this. Maybe we'll do that a little more often. It was interesting. I like that. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any of our discussions, breaking updates on the cases that we are following for you. And infomercial offers to get brand new juicers. But wait, there's more. If you call right now, Time Life Music will include sounds of whales bleating. I just love it. Kind of seems like that music, doesn't it? Anyway, press subscribe so you don't miss any of our updates and discussions right here. My name is Tony Bruschi. You can follow me online at Tony B Pod. Stay with us.